Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording at our studio in East County. Today we open up with some top local stories, starting with an update on a bill advancing in the legislature that critics call a power grab by San Diego politicians on the SANDAG board, a move that would take away the power of other local cities and the county's unincorporated communities. Then on Green Scene, hear about the March for Science that took place on Saturday across the nation and here in San Diego. Plus, hear why the last offshore oil drilling along California's coast will soon be history. District Attorney Bonnie Jimenez is retiring and may be running for another local office. Hear which one and why the Democratic Party chair is calling for an independent investigation into the district attorney's office on today's show. On our education report, learn about a bill to crack down on privately run charter schools in California. Then we'll share results of the latest homeless count in our region, including some disturbing trends in San Diego County and right here in East County. Learn where you can drop off prescription drugs that you no longer need for a National Prescription Drug Take-Back Day that's coming up. A proposal to drop the Aztec's name at San Diego State University has been voted down. But we'll tell you why this issue isn't dead yet on today's show. On this Earth Day week, we thought it would be a good time to replay an important interview we did last year with Dr. Jeffrey Severinghouse. He's one of the world's top climate scientists from Scripps Institute right here in San Diego. Next up, find out how to sign up for Community Emergency Response Team or CERT training before the start of fire season. April is Women's History Month. So we'll share a delightful story about a strong woman from La Mesa's past who helped win the vote for women in California and cityhood for La Mesa. And finally, learn how to stay safe before digging in your garden by making sure you know where any gas lines may be buried. We'll have all these stories and more on today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters.
Assembly Bill 805 passed the Assembly Local Government Committee on Wednesday by a 5-4 vote. The measure claims to reform SANDAG, but in fact gives virtually all power to the cities of San Diego and Chula Vista, leaving East County cities and other communities in our county powerless to add agenda items to benefit other cities or block objectionable measures at SANDAG, the Metropolitan Transit System, and North County Transit District. Now, East County cities are fighting back. On Tuesday, La Mesa's City Council will consider a proposal from Council Members Bill Baber and Christine Alicio to hire a legislative lobbyist to advocate on La Mesa's behalf against AB 805, which was authored by San Diego Assemblymember Lorena Gonzalez-Fletcher. El Cajon City Council has voted to oppose AB 805, as did Lemon Grove and La Mesa. East County Assemblyman Randy Vopel, former Mayor of Santee, voted against the measure in committee. Gonzalez-Fletcher, who represents San Diego and Chula Vista, says the measure is needed because SANDAG was caught misinforming the public on cost of a recent failed transportation ballot initiative. But her bill goes much farther than requiring an independent audit and investigation. It shifts the balance of power to give a majority vote to San Diego and Chula Vista, which she justifies based on their larger population size. Lemon Grove Councilman Jerry Jones has sent a letter opposing AB 805 to the Assembly Transportation Committee, where it will next be heard, Jones writes. Allowing San Diego to make decisions unilaterally with a weighted vote only at SANDAG would be the end of the regional collaboration and decision-making. There would simply be no incentive for them to work collaboratively with the other jurisdictions in the region or to embrace the consensus we've come to know in the region. He also objects to the bill granting chairmanship to San Diego and Chula Vista on a rotating basis, shutting out other cities in the county from a leadership role on SANDAG. Jones argues that SANDAG is not broken, as Gonzalez Fletcher contends, noting that regional collaboration has in fact produced two successful measures in the past, Transnet and Transnet 2, both approved by voters. AB 805 has been amended to remove one objection raised by small cities in the region. Originally, it required that only mayors could serve on the SANDAG board, but that was deleted after objections from cities with part-time mayors who work day jobs that would make it hard to attend a SANDAG meeting. But Jones says the measure is really a power grab that seeks to take power away from everyone and every jurisdiction outside of those represented by Gonzalez Fletcher. Councilman Jones told East County Magazine, "I will argue that my minority and low-income citizens have just as much right to be fairly represented as San Diego and Chula Vista. While accountability and transparency elements of the bill have merit," he concludes, "good decisions and change are made from proper examination of facts and not political vendettas." Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Gene Carpenter.
Now it's time for the Green Scene Report, highlighting energy, environmental, and sustainability issues in our community.
On Saturday, an Earth Day March for Science was held in hundreds of cities across the United States. Here in San Diego, police estimate that over 15,000 people marched through downtown San Diego, including prominent scientists from Scripps Institute of Oceanography, medical research, and San Diego's biotech industry. The event was backed by UCSD and the Reuben H. Fleet Science Center in Balboa Park. Scientists spoke out in the Civic Center Plaza in front of City Hall, followed by a march down Broadway to the Waterfront Park outside the County Administration Center. They carried signs such as "Science Makes America Great," "Climate Science is Real," "Science Rocks," and "There is no Planet B." Participants hoped to raise awareness about the importance of science at a time when the Trump administration is slashing budgets for scientific research, including money for the National Institute of Health and the Environmental Protection Agency. The Trump administration has also gutted science-based regulations to protect clean air and water and muzzled federal employees from even speaking about climate change. At the rally, Congressman Brad Sherman from Sherman Oaks criticized the Trump administration's denial of climate change. He stated, "Policy should be guided by scientific consensus, scientific facts, not alternative facts. Science has been used to achieve great good, but also has the power to unleash devastating weapons of war." Martha Dina Arguello, executive director of Physicians for Social Responsibility in Los Angeles, came to San Diego to speak. "Today, the Cold War is over, and the nuclear threat is not," she said, calling for disarmament. The scientific community is one area where equality has made huge strides. California Senate President Pro Tem Kevin De Leon told the crowd in San Diego, "One half of our scientists in California today are immigrants." Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Miriam Raftery.
The last remaining offshore oil platform in California waters will now be decommissioned after the company that owns it, Venoco, declared bankruptcy and handed the lease back to the state. Platform Holly, off of Santa Barbara, was shut down 2 years ago after a nearby pipe owned by a different company burst, spilling 142,000 gallons of oil onto Refugio Beach. But Linda Kropp, with the Environmental Defense Center, says the company had been trying to expand its operations and was seeking permission to slant drill up to 4 miles from the platform, something her group has been fighting for decades.
Platform Holly and the related pier that will also be decommissioned have been operating for more than 50 years. You know, this is aging infrastructure that poses significant risks of air pollution, gas leaks, and oil spills.
Venoco said in a statement that the ongoing closure of the pipeline it needs to transport the oil led to the decision. The California State Lands Commission now will be charged with permanently plugging the wells. Kropp says this is a turning point in oil drilling up and down the state because it sends a signal to the Trump administration, which reportedly is considering reopening a 5-year plan that was finalized near the end of President Obama's time in office.
President Trump has expressed interest in opening up additional areas for leasing, and we're very concerned that the California coast could be added to that plan.
There has been no federal oil and gas leasing in waters off of California since 1984. However, a lot of oil and gas infrastructure remains, so stakeholders are waiting for word from the Department of the Interior on whether it will reverse Obama-era limits on offshore drilling. For Public News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
District Attorney Bonnie Dumanis has announced that she will retire on July 7th. She is considering running to replace Supervisor Ron Roberts, who is stepping down after 2018 due to term limits, 10 News reports. Under county policy, supervisors will appoint someone to replace Dumanis for the remainder of her term, which ends in January 2019. At their May 2nd meeting, supervisors will announce the application period and candidate requirements, also approving dates for public hearings to consider all applications and finalists. In a prepared statement, Dumanis says serving as district attorney has been an honor and a rewarding experience, adding, "I'm very proud of the unparalleled crime prevention and public outreach programs we've put in place and our unwavering commitment to supporting victims of crime." Dumanis announced her decision to retire before her term ends just 2 days after press reports revealed that she was a subject of the investigation in the Ezzano corruption scandal. County Democratic Party Chair Jessica Hayes released a statement calling on supervisors to launch an independent investigation headed by a special prosecutor into the DA office's connection with the Ezzano corruption scandal, and for all candidates seeking appointment to fill the vacancy to also support an independent investigation. Hayes said it would be a breach of the public's trust to appoint a new DA until the independent investigation is finished. She concludes, "The public deserves to know the extent of the district attorney's involvement in the Ezzano corruption scandal and whether any other personnel in the DA's office acted improperly." Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Gene Carpenter.
This is Miriam Raftery with an education report from East County Magazine on KNSJ. A California bill aims to crack down on profiteering by private charter schools that have been pocketing public funds while providing a poor quality education to students, Cal Matters reports. The actions follow an investigation last year by the San Jose Mercury News, which found that K-12 Inc., the state's largest for-profit charter school company, graduated less than half the students it signed up through its online academy. Two-thirds of its students fell below statewide averages for math, and half were not proficient in reading. Kids could get credit for being present by just logging on for as little as a minute each day. U.S. Secretary of Education Betsy DeVos and her husband were early investors in K-12 Inc. While chairing the American Federation for Children, a group advocating school choice, DeVos pushed for expanding access to online virtual schools such as K-12, in which she had a financial stake. As education secretary, she continues to tout for-profit charters that suck funds out of the public education system. K-12 has been riddled by scandals, most recently including a securities fraud lawsuit filed by shareholders who claim the company made false or misleading statements to investors, Business Wire reports. According to SourceWatch, K-12 was founded by former Goldman Sachs executive Ron Packard and former U.S. Secretary of Education and right-wing talk show host William Bennett back in 1999. Packard was able to start K-12 Inc. with $10 million from convicted junk bond king Michael Milken and $30 million more from other Wall Street investors. The American Exchange Council, or ALEC, passed a Model Virtual Schools Act to tout online schools such as K-12 Inc. ALEC has been working to push this effort at the state level. In California, ALEC is chaired by State Senator Joel Anderson, a Republican from Alpine whose district includes most of East County. Studies by the National Education Policy Center in 2012 and 2013 found that nationwide, only 28% of K-12 Inc.'s online schools met adequate yearly progress requirements, compared to 52% of public schools that met those standards for academic achievement. Less than 1 in 5 of K-12 schools even managed to obtain satisfactory ratings from states that issued them. Nationwide, while public high schools graduated over 79% of their students, only about 37% of K-12 students graduated, SourceWatch has documented. Now, San Diego has had its own charter school scandal recently when former Mountain Empire School District Superintendent Steve Van Zandt pled guilty to a felony. Known as the King of Charter Schools, he violated conflict of interest provisions of the Political Reform Act by setting up 13 charter schools in other districts overseen by Mountain Empire, a financially struggling rural district in East County that got money for its supervision of charters elsewhere, often in high-performing districts. All the while, Van Zandt was lining his own pocket in several cases by having those charters hire his consulting firm, EdHive. Assemblyman Kevin McCarty, author of AB 406, says, When we allow private companies to run public schools, we invite them to focus on shareholders and profit margins instead of on children and student achievement. Profiting off the public good is bad public policy, McCarty concludes. His bill would outlaw all for-profit companies and management organizations from operating charter schools in California. Fighting back, the California Charter Schools Association is backing its own measure, Senate Bill 806 by Steve Glaser. Their measure does not ban private charters, but instead would prohibit for-profit companies from picking school board members, overseeing teachers, or approving budgets. It would also require all charter schools to comply with California's open meeting laws under the Brown Act, as well as open records laws. Both bills are expected to be considered by education committees in the legislature next month.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice.
The annual count of San Diego County's homeless population found 9,116 people living on the streets or in shelters. That's a 5% increase from last year countywide. The results were released last week from the point-in-time count held in the early morning hours of January 27th. The effort is organized by the Regional Task Force on the Homeless. In East County, the count found 685 homeless people, of whom nearly all, 620 of them, were unsheltered. That's a 7% increase in homelessness in East County over the past year. Among East County communities, El Cajon had by far the highest number of homeless people, 388, and only 65 were in any sort of shelter. Among the other unincorporated cities in East County, Santee had 49 homeless people, Lemon Grove 36, and La Mesa 25. All of the homeless in these cities are living without any shelter at all. Homelessness is also high in some unincorporated communities. Overall, the unincorporated areas of the county have 326 homeless people, and 320 of those are without shelter. Lakeside had 77, Ramona 65, Spring Valley 61, Casa de Oro 30, and Alpine 19. Some areas where a count was done found no homeless people, however, including the Jamul del Zura and Crestahisa communities. The annual count helps determine the number and location of homeless people in the San Diego region and is critical in securing about $18 million worth of federal funding for needed housing and services. One area that did improve in our region is the number of homeless veterans, decreased by 16.2% over the last year. But a particularly troublesome finding was that homelessness among young people has risen to 1,150, of whom over 1,000 are youths between ages 18 and 24. With a 54% spike in the number of homeless youths who are unsheltered in San Diego County. Now, the researchers asked these homeless people locally to name the primary reason why they are homeless. A quarter of them said loss of a job was the main cause. Another quarter listed other causes not specified, but 15% listed money issues as the main reason why they are homeless. 10% had run away or been thrown out of their homes. 7% named loss of a family member. Another 7% cited disability, and about the same number cited abuse or domestic violence. A small fraction, 3%, listed recent release from prison, and 1% had aged out of foster care. The findings show that the causes of homelessness are varied as the San Diego region continues to grapple with its growing homeless population amid rising housing prices that have made San Diego one of the most unaffordable places to live in the nation. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Miriam Raftery.
This is Cindy Hanna with a public service announcement from the U.S. Drug Enforcement Agency, or the DEA. Each year, the DEA holds a Prescription Drug Take-Back Day. Residents are encouraged to turn in unused prescription drugs and avoid having them fall into the hands of thieves or drug abusers or children. This year, the event will be held on April 29th from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. Locations in East County include the Alpine and Lemon Grove Sheriff's Substations, El Cajon and La Mesa Police Departments, the parking lots at Walgreens in Lakeside and Santee, Steel Canyon High School in Spring Valley, and the parking booth on Canyon Crest Drive at San Diego State University. For more locations across San Diego County, visit DEA.gov. For help with prescription drug abuse, you can call 877 662-6384.
A proposal to remove the Aztec's name and Aztec warrior mascot from San Diego State University has been voted down overwhelmingly by the Associated Students University Council. The council voted 24-1 to keep the Aztec's identity. However, a similar proposal will be weighed by the university senate, which will consider the matter in the fall. Those who wanted to eliminate use of the Aztec's name contended that it is offensive to indigenous people. Those who support keeping the Aztec's identity note that the university already went through an extensive review process that started back in 2000. The logo and mascot were altered to better reflect Aztec culture and history, eliminating the cartoonish Monty Montezuma back in 2006. On social media, alumni have weighed in on the recent proposal, arguing that no decision to eliminate the school's long-standing name or mascot should be made without including the university's many proud Aztecs alumni in the process. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the desert to the sea.
The East County Magazine Show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interest, not special interest. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. Now stay tuned for part two of the East County Magazine radio show. And now on the heels of the National March for Science that happened this last weekend, we thought this would be a good time to replay our interview with one of the world's top climate scientists, Dr. Jeffrey Severinghaus, from the Scripps Institute of Oceanography right here in San Diego. This interview originally aired in February 2016 at the time of the Paris Climate Summit, but his message is even more important now than ever. Now, straight from the headlines, bringing you our latest top newsmakers. This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso. In the last week, climate change has been much in the news with the Global Climate Summit going on in Paris and Climate Change March in San Diego. I've been interviewing prominent politicians, and a couple of them, when I told them about the 97% of the world's climate scientists who now believe that climate change is real and that man is contributing to it, you know, a couple of them said, well, who are these climate scientists? So we thought it would be a good idea to bring one on the show.
Great. I'm a card-carrying climate scientist.
Right. So skeptics, tune in. My very special guest today is Jeff Severinghaus. He is a noted climate scientist and professor of geosciences at Scripps Institute of Oceanography at the University of California, San Diego. He was recently elected to the prestigious National Academy of Sciences, an organization of top scientists founded by Congress way back under President Abraham Lincoln, dedicated to advising the federal government and furthering science for the public good. His research focuses on using gas bubbles trapped in ice cores to track changes in ancient climate change. He's done measurements in Antarctica and Greenland, and his newest research raises the question of whether the addition of carbon dioxide to the atmosphere through the burning of fossil fuels could also produce a more rapid change in climate than many computer models on global climate have already predicted. He was a Clara C. Patterson medalist of the Geochemical Society for his breakthrough research in environmental geochemistry, and he's held several fellowships, including a graduate fellowship with the National Oceanographic Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA, and with the University of California and the American Geophysical Union. Most recently, NOAA's annual State of the Climate report came out and revealed that 7 climate records were broken in 2014. Jeff Severinghaus, our guest today, has famously observed that if this is the Earth's annual checkup, the doctor is saying you are gravely ill. Jeffrey, welcome to the show.
Thanks for inviting me, Marian. It's good to be here.
Tell us how you first became involved in studying climate change, of all things.
Well, when I was growing up, I spent a lot of time outdoors. My dad, you know, took me on long backpacking trips and, you know, just I became a lover of the outdoors, and I knew that my career somehow had to include being outdoors. And so I gravitated towards geology and geochemistry. And I think that's probably how I eventually ended up studying climate.
Very good. You call yourself a paleoclimatologist. Can you tell our listeners what exactly that means?
Yeah, paleoclimatology just means the study of ancient climate change, and it helps us understand how the climate system works so that we can predict better what's going to happen in the future.
Very important. I've got some figures here that over a million years of ice ages and hot spells, the ice cores showed the carbon dioxide levels ranged from just under 200 parts per million to under 300 parts per million. But since the industrial age, about 200 years ago, when all the factories started pumping fossil fuels into the atmosphere, the CO2 levels have risen to 400 parts per million today. So, Jeffrey, there's certainly a lot of skeptics out there who aren't convinced that climate change is real. For those folks, is there any scientific validation behind those who say that today's levels are just part of a natural cycle?
No, definitely not. The CO2 that we measure in the ice cores, you know, showing it variations, as you said, between about 200 and 300 parts per million over the ice age cycles, that CO2 came out of the ocean. It was a natural CO2, and it has a completely different chemistry than the CO2 that's accumulating in the atmosphere right now, which is from fossil fuels. And you can tell the difference between the two types of CO2, actually. They're not the same gas, even. So it's an absolutely no doubt that humans are causing the current increase in CO2, and it's coming from fossil fuels, and it's got all the fingerprints of fossil fuel CO2, not oceanic CO2.
Thank you for educating our listeners on that very important point. Can you summarize some of your most important research findings and what you're doing?
Yeah, so I'm mostly trying to understand what causes rapid climate change. Sometimes we call it abrupt climate change, because that is one of the great unknowns going into the future. As humans add gases to the atmosphere that cause warming, it is possible, though we can't say for sure, that some threshold will be crossed and the system will snap into a totally new state, which could be much, much warmer.
How much warmer? How bad could it get?
Well, just to give you an example, we know from looking at the ice cores that about 12,000 years ago, there was a 15 degree Fahrenheit warming in Greenland that was obviously not caused by humans. That was a natural mm-hmm. event. But the whole thing happened in about 10 years. And so It's very, very fast. That's what we call abrupt climate change. And so if humans were to sort of accidentally trigger something like that in the future, then, you know, we'd be looking at much more profound consequences with, you know, 15 degrees Fahrenheit, it, you know, being a much more severe number than the currently predicted, 5 to 8 degrees Fahrenheit that the computer models are suggesting.
Right. That's where we can get into rising seas and areas of drought where agriculture would not be possible, or maybe areas that wouldn't really sustain human life.
Right.
Let's talk about the recent findings from NOAA, that annual State of the Climate Report we just talked about that you said indicates the doctor says you're gravely ill. Here were some of the findings of it, about 7 climate records that were broken last year alone. It was the hottest year on record in many places around the world since record keeping began. That includes Europe, Africa, Asia, Mexico, and parts of South America. Greenhouse gas emissions are also up. Sea surface temperatures were the highest on record, and so were ocean temperatures, since oceans trap those greenhouse gases. The sea levels are also rising, over 2.5 inches since 1993, as the glaciers are melting. And speaking of glaciers, Antarctica's rate of ice melting broke a record last year, too, and Greenland's ice melting rate was also above average. So, Jeffrey, you've done some research involving the oceans and their role in all of this. Can you tell us how important the role of oceans is in climate change?
Yeah, oceans are very important, and the reason is that they soak up an enormous amount of heat. The extra energy that's entering our planet's system right now because of greenhouse gases is an enormous number, and 93% of that energy is actually going into warming up the ocean.
Wow.
It's just because water has a very, very high capacity to hold heat. And so the ocean, in a sense, is our friend. It's actually keeping it from being nearly as warm as it would be. We would have had about double the warming that we've actually had if we didn't have an ocean to soak up all that excess heat.
What are the consequences of ocean warming at such a rapid rate?
Well, the thing that happens when water warms, it expands. So just the warming of the ocean itself causes sea level rise, mm-hmm. in addition to the melting of glaciers. So it's right now it's about half and half. About half of the sea level rise is due to ocean warming.
Yeah. So that can impact everything from the wildlife, fishing and whales and things in the ocean, but also the weather patterns. When we talk about an El Nino, that is fueled by global climate change, ocean warming. A lot of people have a misconception, I think, that climate change only means warming, but it can also mean extreme weather patterns that bring, hurricanes, snow, all these other things. Do you want to comment a little bit on that?
Yeah, the very snowy winters that we've had paradoxically are a consequence of human-caused warming. And the reason is that the atmosphere becomes more wavy as it becomes warmer. And so you get these jet stream waves that sort of bring cold air very far south during some winters, but not others. Mm-hmm. So we're going to be seeing a lot more extreme weather. We're going to be seeing heat waves, real scorchers like the one that killed 70,000 people in Europe in 2003. And then we're going to see, be seeing some very snowy winters where it'll be, in a deep freeze and over the eastern U.S. for a whole month, at a time, that kind mm-hmm. of thing. So people shouldn't be surprised by those very cold
change.
Winters. Yeah.
In the past has included ice ages. Could we have another ice age?
No, absolutely not. Because right now all of the big glaciers in the world are melting like gangbusters. And so they're not, to get an ice age, basically you have to build a huge ice sheet.
Yeah.
And so it's not going to happen.
Tell me a little bit about the core samples that you've actually pulled out and what some of the findings are that your own research has discovered.
Yeah, so my students and I wanted to test this idea that methane would come bubbling out of the ocean and out of the tundra and cause excess warming, additional warming, mm-hmm. in what we call a feedback, where heating causes release of gas, which then causes more heating, which then causes more release of gas.
So a vicious cycle.
Yeah, so we wanted to give that hypothesis, as we say in science, a rigorous test, and so we measured a gas in the bubbles in the ancient ice called carbon-14, which is another one of these rare forms of carbon, and we were able to show that during the last abrupt warming event that happened about 12,000 years ago, these methane sources were not active, and so in a sense, that's good news. I mean, that's one of these threats that we can check off saying, nope, that, we don't have to worry about that one. So that's one of the achievements of my group, is to show that the methane problem that has been talked about so much of, Arctic methane coming bubbling out, that's actually not going to happen.
So it's the CO2 and the greenhouse gases that we're putting into the atmosphere ourselves that are their concern, not
That's
things
right.
that have been stored there for a gazillion years.
Yeah, exactly. So the CO2 is really the problem, that it stays in the atmosphere so long. It's roughly speaking about a third of it will be left after 100 years if you put a certain amount of CO2 in the atmosphere. So what we're doing is we're effectively setting a time bomb for our great grandchildren, and it has a 100-year long fuse.
Wow. Can you please explain your innovative theory of what some writers have called a stripping of clouds that normally cover the ocean, how that's happened in the past and what that could mean for the future?
Yeah, so this comes out of, again, from the ice core research. What we found in the ice cores is that the southern hemisphere, from Antarctica to southern South America to New Zealand, all these places show a dramatic warming upwards of 12 degrees Fahrenheit in a rather short time, just a few hundred years, at the end of the last ice age. And looks like the whole end of the last ice age was really triggered by this southern hemisphere rapid warming.
What caused that?
And it's not known. So my theory is really an attempt to explain that dramatic warming. And I should emphasize that this theory is not proven yet. It's just a theory. But the idea is that the ocean is very dark in its color. Think of a black parking lot on a hot summer day. And then think of how much cooler that parking lot would be if it were painted white. That's the essence of the idea. It's really very simple. The clouds are white and ocean is dark. So if you take in a part of the earth, which today is almost always covered by clouds.
The ocean.
The eastern, southern hemisphere, Pacific Ocean is where I'm thinking mostly. This area currently reflects a lot of sunlight back to space because it's white. Mm-hmm. If you were to strip off those clouds, you could suddenly have sun shining on dark colored ocean.
So it's going to absorb a lot more heat directly.
Absorbs a lot more heat directly. And so that's my hypothesis.
What makes the clouds be stripped away?
Yeah. And so atmospheric circulation, it turns out, if you move the whole rain belt, the tropical rain belts, into the southern hemisphere because of rapid southern hemisphere warming, you will strip away all those low clouds in the southern hemisphere tropical Pacific.
So the warming that occurs from pumping CO2 into the atmosphere from all these cars and factories and so forth can actually accelerate stripping away the clouds. So you're not only getting more CO2, but you're also allowing more sunlight into the planet. Is that what you're saying?
Almost, but not quite. It's the uneven heating that's the problem. So in other words, if our descendants, let's say, decide they want to artificially cool the climate, what's called geoengineering.
Okay. That's a fascinating idea.
Yeah. They spray sulfur into the atmosphere and it reflects sunlight back to space. And it's been discussed widely, though it's probably not a very good idea.
And what's the downside of it?
Well, it causes acid rain for one thing. Oh. It can cause ozone depletion for another. But perhaps most seriously, it could shift rain patterns around. And that would have tragic consequences for the billion or so people on Earth who make their livelihood from rain-fed agriculture. So anyway, it's...
Don't mess with Mother Nature,
yeah,
in other words.
But I'm saying that if for some reason people decide to cool off the northern hemisphere but not the southern hemisphere, then based on what we understand now, the rain belts will shift south, and that could trigger this big additional...
At 15 degrees,
warming,
like you're talking
about.
How high could this go? And how close are we to the tipping point? What is the tipping point beyond which climate change could be irreversible based upon your scientific study of this issue?
Yeah, it's a very difficult question. You know, we don't, unfortunately, know very well where that tipping point actually is. Many people over the years have said that 2 degrees is probably a safe number that we should not exceed, and that's 2 degrees centigrade or 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit. And the scientific basis.
And that's an increase from when to when?
From pre-industrial, say from 1850 to whatever time we're talking
about. And how much
about.
Has it risen already?
It's already risen 0.8 centigrade, so we're almost halfway to that sort of danger point, 2 degrees.
How soon could we reach the tipping point if we don't do anything?
Well, that's the problem, is that really it's a really hard question to answer, because we don't have enough fundamental understanding of, you know, how to predict these tipping points. They're notoriously difficult to predict.
And but the consequences of doing nothing obviously could be.
Yeah. So
huge.
It's sort of a risk management question. If, you know, if your doctor says to you that you have a very high likelihood of a heart attack, but I can't tell you exactly what day your heart attack is going to happen.
There you go. But
would you just ignore your doctor's advice?
Good point. Or do you try to get your cholesterol down?
Yeah. Medical science isn't quite up to the task yet of predicting which day your heart attack is going to happen, but that still means you don't ignore your doctor.
Right.
That's kind of the place we're in with this abrupt climate change.
Okay. Can it be stopped is probably the $64,000 question there. And if so, what should we be doing to halt or reverse this trend?
Yeah, it's a great question. First of all, yes, it absolutely can be stopped. Don't listen to anyone who says that it's too late. We're all doomed. Let's just party until we die. Don't listen to those people. Okay. I mean, there is absolutely a lot we can do. And the big, easy things to do that we should absolutely be doing right now is just converting everything to solar, especially in Southern California. Mm-hmm. We need to be all driving electric cars 30 years from now.
To charge up on our solar systems.
We're blessed with abundant sunshine, mm-hmm. so we can all be driving solar-powered cars, basically. Mm-hmm. And so that trend is already sort of underway. It's, you know, but there needs to be public money spent because the private sector is still unwilling to take the big risks that are needed to invent the new technologies to make batteries a lot lighter and cheaper and make solar panels cheaper. So basically we need a revolution in how we get our energy. And it is possible, but it's going to take a little bit of priming the pump, basically. So
that brings me to a question about the Paris Climate Summit. As we're taping this, the world leaders are still meeting in Paris. They're just wrapping up the Global Climate Summit. Based on what you've seen so far happening in Paris, what is your assessment of the takeaway from that? Is enough being done? Are the world leaders taking this seriously enough, Jeffrey?
Well, I have to say I'm very encouraged by and very hopeful by what's going on in Paris right now. But if you just look at the numbers, they don't quite add up. I mean, the commitments to reduce CO2 emissions that have been put on the table at Paris are only about half of what's really needed to solve the problem. Effectively,
wow. we so just- If they did everything, if they adopted every single proposal,
yeah.
it still only gets us halfway.
It gets halfway, yeah. And so a lot of people have been acknowledging that openly. It's not like it's any secret, but what many of the world leaders are saying is this is just the beginning. It's politically too difficult to go all the way right now. But so we're taking baby steps. We're going to revisit this in another 5 years and then another 5 years after that. And hopefully by then the politics will be more amenable.
We are seeing some progress. We're seeing the Chinese come to the table for the first time. Of course, they're one of the hugest polluters with the coal plants and so forth. So, I mean, that's a promising sign. But also around the world, a lot of places are saying we don't have to wait for our world leaders to take action. Let's do something ourselves. Aren't we seeing a movement of a lot of local mayors, for example? And I think the San Diego City Council is going to be voting in the next couple of weeks on going to a 100% renewable energy plan for the city.
Yeah, it's wonderful to see all the local action that's happening. Jerry Brown, our governor, has been really out in front on this issue. And, of course, he's been at the Paris talks, and he corralled basically enough cities and towns and states to account for a quarter of all global emissions of carbon dioxide.
Wow.
And they're all forming their own sort of action team, and they're going ahead. They're not waiting for the United Nations to do the work.
Well, that's fantastic. And I think that sometimes when it's done locally, in some ways it's done better. For example, in East County, I know not everyone was thrilled about the wind projects that, you know, the governor was a big supporter of because of the environmental damage of clear cutting, you know, 12,000 acres to put them in. But if you give a community a say so, and they say, you know, we're happy to all put solar on our roofs or change what we drive or adopt mass transit. There's many, many approaches that can be taken to get us to the same goal, but with the support of the people that live in the communities instead of someone coming down and saying, you know, this is the only way to make it happen.
And I'm very encouraged that the private sector is really jumping into the fray. You know, Bill Gates and Elon Musk and a whole bunch of other super billionaires all put out a statement last week saying that they are going to put huge resources into figuring out how to make batteries lighter, how to make solar panels cheaper, you know, all these important things that are going to be part of the solution.
So when we see the 1% turning around saying we have to do something about this, we should all pay attention, I think.
No, it's very, very
hopeful. The greatest scientific and technology minds.
One way to look at this is in sort of crass monetary terms is that somebody is going to get filthy rich from this big energy transition that has to happen. So it's a kind of a question of, well, who is going to get super rich from doing this?
And speaking of the money, we really should mention that when we hear these prominent climate science deniers, many of them aren't even scientists. They're politicians or other folks out there. But there's an awful lot of money, isn't there, behind that, that's coming from, guess who, the fossil fuel industry that has so much to lose if we transition away from coal and oil and gas. Does this remind you of, you know, a couple decades ago when we saw the tobacco industry out there hiring so-called medical experts to say that tobacco doesn't cause cancer, cigarettes aren't bad for your health? And of course, they knew all along that it was.
Yeah, it's fascinating to read the papers about, you know, the last week or two about Exxon being investigated by the Attorney General of New York State.
Tell us some more about that.
Well, it turns out that Exxon had a lot of top scientists working on the problem in the 1960s and 1970s. Mm-hmm. And there was no secrets. The scientists were allowed to freely publish their own work. And they all said, you know, burning fossil fuels is going to cause global warming. And this is a problem. And the Exxon management was okay with that. And it turned out that in 1981, something flipped, something switched. You know, basically Exxon stopped funding all this basic scientific research.
Yeah, I wonder why. They didn't like the outcome too well.
Well, you know, it's tempting to speculate that their financial people just took a look at the numbers and said, if we want to make our stockholders happy, we just have to shut up and keep pumping. And so it's kind of a tragedy. But yeah, maybe there's a flaw in our economic system in that to keep the shareholders happy, you eventually do things that are not in the long-term best interests of everyone, including yourself.
Yeah, it is. It's sort of a self-destructive.
It's sort of a short-term versus long-term problem or something.
I'm going to give you the last word today, Jeffrey. What else would you like our listeners to know about climate change that we have not already mentioned today?
Well, I view climate change as a very soluble problem. I'm not a doom and gloom kind of guy at all. You know, I think there's a lot in common with sewage treatment, frankly. Nobody is against sewage treatment today. There is no such thing as a Republican position on sewage treatment or a Democratic position on sewage treatment. We just have to clean up after ourselves, and we all agree on that. I think in another 100 years, climate change is going to be seen the same way, just like we got to clean up after ourselves. And I think that it's very possible to do that. When sewage treatment was first introduced as an idea in the 1700s and then later in the 1800s, conservatives said that it would ruin the economy. Sound familiar?
It does. Fascinating.
And,
I did not know,
you know
that.
And I don't mean to make light of it, because actually at that time, pipes were not cheap. You know, you think about putting pipes through a whole city, you might actually, well, that's going to break the bank, you know, but it was possible. We did it. How did we do it? You know, a little bit at a time, incrementally. But it is absolutely possible to make this energy transition. And it's even possible to make a lot of money doing it. And I think one of the things I love about San Diego is that there's a lot of entrepreneurs in San Diego who have precisely this idea that they are going to make money by producing green technologies and making, you know, jobs. And who's against, you know, having more jobs and more money?
Nobody's Absolutely. We really are the hub of the green tech, clean tech industry at a national level right here
Absolutely.
In San Diego.
Yeah.
Right on the forefront of it.
And we could be better. We could be the go-to place for solar technology.
Listeners, if you tuned in late, we've been speaking with Jeff Severinghaus, who is a noted climate scientist from the Scripps Institute of Oceanography right here at the University of California, San Diego. Jeffrey, I want to thank you so very much for taking the time out of your busy schedule to join us today on the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice.
Thank you, Miriam.
This is Rebecca Williamson with a public service announcement from Heartland Fire and Rescue. Are you prepared for a disaster such as an earthquake or firestorm? Heartland Fire and Rescue invites you to attend a Community Emergency Response Team, or CERT, Academy. Free disaster training will be taught by members of Heartland Fire and Rescue and Santee Fire Department in classes that begin May 6th. There are 6 classes held on consecutive Saturdays from 8:30 a.m. to 12:30 p.m. The CERT program educates people about disaster preparedness and hazards that may impact the area where they live. These free CERT lessons will train you in basic disaster response skills such as fire safety, light search and rescue, team organization, and disaster medical operations. Using the training taught in a classroom and during drill exercises, CERT members will be better prepared to also assist others in their neighborhood or workplace after a disaster if professional responders are not immediately available. Registration is required. You can learn more and register at heartlandfire.org. Due to the limited class size, the East County CERT training offered by Heartland Fire and Rescue is restricted to residents of El Cajon, La Mesa, Lemon Grove, and Santee. The CERT program is run by the Federal Emergency Management Agency, or FEMA. If you live in another community not included in Heartland Fire's program, you can visit FEMA.gov. Put CERT into the search bar to find a CERT program in your neighborhood.
This is Helen Ofield from the Lemon Grove Historical Society, bringing you the sounds of history.
This is Miriam Raftery, guest hosting the Sounds of History on the East County Magazine Show. April is Women's History Month. It's an appropriate time to share a story about a remarkable woman from East County's past. Helen Stoddard, a former resident of La Mesa, Lemon Grove, and Ramona, was a prominent leader in the fight to win women the right to vote, as well as in the temperance movement. She even earned a place in history at the national political level. Born in 1850 in Wisconsin, Stoddard earned a teaching degree at Genesee Wesleyan Seminary in New York, graduating as valedictorian in 1873. She married Shepherd Stoddard and had two sons, one of whom died in infancy. They lived briefly in Nebraska, but soon her husband's health was failing, so the family moved to Florida. And after he died in 1875, when Helen Stoddard was just 25 years old, she and her surviving young son moved to Texas to be near her parents. There, she became president of the Texas State Chapter of the Women's Christian Temperance Union, concerned over the negative impacts of alcoholism on women and their families. She also served on the faculty of Fort Worth University and helped establish a women's industrial arts college that today is known as Texas Women's University, where two buildings were named after her. She became an activist, lobbying successfully for a pure food law and laws against cocaine, gambling, child labor, raising the age of protection for girls from 12 to 15 in Texas, and more. She spent 3 months in Mexico as an organizer and twice served as a delegate to world conventions of the Women's Christian Temperance Union. She also wrote an article on the Texas suffrage movement for Susan B. Anthony's book, History of Woman Suffrage. In 1910, Helen Stoddard and her son moved to La Mesa, where she was soon elected president of the La Mesa Women's Club, which incidentally was founded in 1902 and is the city's oldest active service club today. She also headed up the local chapter of the Women's Christian Temperance Society, forerunner of the Prohibition movement. Local women embarked on barnstorming tours across the county to win support from men for women to gain the right to vote in California. La Mesa's newspaper and other local papers editorialized in favor of granting this right, since progressives in the region recognized that women would be key allies in local political issues and supporting social reforms related to child labor, public health, and regulating alcohol and vice. La Mesa Scout editorialized that the right of women to vote is as absolute as that of a man. In October 1911, California's legislature amended the state constitution, granting women the right to vote. Days later, Helen Stoddard loaded up motor cars with about 40 members of the La Mesa Women's Club and headed to the Registrar of Voters office in downtown San Diego, registering them all to vote. In La Mesa, then known as La Mesa Springs, a battle was brewing over incorporation to become a city. Supporters wanted the city to control its own water supply and support public education, among other goals. But there was strong opposition, mainly from ranchers who feared that their taxes would go up. Early efforts at incorporation faltered until the women got involved and won the right to vote. A meeting at the La Mesa Opera House on December 1, 1911, ended in disorder without a vote on whether to incorporate after vocal opponents showed up. Supporters brought their case to the supervisors, and among the speakers arguing to the supervisors was suffrage leader Helen Stoddard. The district attorney reviewed the petition but rejected it at first for not meeting requirements to publish notices 3 times over 2 weeks. So the supporters circulated a new petition and adjusted boundaries to remove some of their key opponents. In February 1912, a new meeting was convened at the city's Opera House, a building that today is the Porfavor Restaurant in downtown La Mesa. Citizens nominated candidates for public office in case the incorporation petition passed, and Helen Stoddard was nominated to serve, but she declined. Turned out she had higher ambitions, and we'll tell you about that in a minute. On February 7, 1912, a special election was held and the incorporation measure passed with help from La Mesa's newly registered women. Soon after, Stoddard declared her intention to run for Congress on the Prohibition Party ticket. She was the first woman in California to seek national office. Her campaign targeted women with the slogan, "A vote for Helen Stoddard is a vote for the home." She didn't win, but she did draw over 1,300 votes out of over 20,000 cast for five candidates in the race. A year later, she and her son Robert and his wife moved to Lemon Grove, where they spent the next 10 years. And in 1923, they moved to Ramona, where her son raised turkeys and chickens, while his mother continued her work in the temperance movement from their home overlooking the Ramona High School. In 1920, Helen Stoddard was elected president of the California State Chapter of the Women's Christian Temperance Union, and she served as a California delegate to the Congress Against Alcoholism in Washington, D.C. After her son's death in 1936 in Ramona, Stoddard and her daughter-in-law moved to Texas. Helen Stoddard died there in January 1941 at age 90, and her body was returned to San Diego for burial next to her son at Greenwood Memorial Park. She had lived through the Civil War, the Spanish-American War, World War I, and the dawn of World War II. Born in the pioneer era, in her lifetime she advanced education of women and saw women win the right to vote, helped lead the successful fight for La Mesa to become a city, ran for national political office, fought for the passage of the Prohibition Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, but also lived to see that repealed. Throughout her life, she was a tireless fighter for the rights of women and girls, touching the lives of people across our nation to this day.
This is Eberena with a public service announcement from San Diego Gas and Electric. SDG&E has issued a reminder to the public about the importance of calling 811 before you dig. Calling 811 or Underground Service Alert will help avoid possible injury or damage to hidden gas lines or service interruption. Damaging a natural gas line can pose a significant safety risk and disrupt natural gas service. Whether digging at a construction site or at their homes, make a quick 811 phone call to Underground Service Alert to have utility-owned lines marked for free. Before digging, residents, business owners, and contractors should mark the proposed excavation area and call 811 at least 2 business days before the project is scheduled to begin. Underground Service Alert will contact all local utilities for free to have them locate and mark the underground lines, pipes, and cables they own. For more information about safe digging or to submit an online request, visit digalert.org. If you suspect a gas emergency or have questions regarding a gas odor or carbon monoxide, call SDG&E immediately at 800-411-7343. It's important to keep in mind that natural gas is flammable and that something as simple as a spark can serve as an ignition source. Use your sense of sight, hearing, and smell and any of the following signs to alert you to the presence of a gas leak. Look for the following: dirt or water being blown in the air, dead or dying vegetation over or near pipeline areas, a fire or explosion near a pipeline, exposed pipeline after an earthquake, fire, flood, or other disaster, and bubbles in puddles outdoors after a rain. You should listen for an unusual sound such as a hissing, whistling, or roaring sound near a pipeline, and you should smell for the distinctive odor of natural gas. However, although SDG&E adds a distinctive odor to natural gas to aid in the detection of leaks, you should not rely on your sense of smell alone to determine if you have a gas leak. For more safety information, visit sdge.com/safety.
This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County and Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technician, Liz Alper, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, and Pond 5. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.